You're listening to the Electric Sheep Art House Cinema Podcast. This is a belated roundup of films released in art house cinemas in London last autumn. For those of you who keep count, this is number 7 in our series, which I promise will be followed in about a fortnight by the intriguingly titled Art House Cinema Podcast number 8. I'm your host, Alex Fitch, and myself and fellow reviewers from Electric Sheep magazine will be reviewing the likes of Control, The Counterfeiters, and Daywatch. Electric Sheep editor Virginie Sellevy will be talking to Anders Morgenthaler, the director of the controversial Danish cartoon Princess, and I'll be talking to Malcolm McDowell and director Mike Kaplan about their film Never Apologise, a personal visit with Lindsay Anderson. So sit back, pretend we've got some fancy title music, and I hope you enjoy the next hour of indie and world cinema. First up, we have Jessica Fosterkew's review of the Russian vampire epic Nevnoy Dozor, otherwise known as Daywatch, which was released in the UK on the 5th of October and is available on DVD on the 28th of January.
Director Timur Bekmambetov brings us the second in his surrealist vampire trilogy. Following the critical success of Nightwatch, Daywatch has surpassed itself, becoming the highest ever grossing film in Russian box office history. This honour was previously that of Fyodor Bondarchuk's 2005 hit Nine Rota. It is noted on the IMDb that Daywatch's protagonist Anton is seen jumping through an advertisement for Nine Rota in this film, cocky but wonderful. I thoroughly enjoyed Nightwatch, relishing its style and intricacy. Daywatch, if anything, increases the pace and complexity. With characters jumping from one world to another, this makes Philip Pullman's multi-universe plot of the Amber Spyglass look placid. Without spoiling, it is fair to say that the plot revolves around recovering, as suggested by the tagline, the Chalk of Fate, a small obelisk of white chalk with which you can change your own destiny. The second main thread involves Anton's division between his quest to recover his son to the light and his love for a woman, his trainee, or more accurately, a white witch. Since my childhood love of Quantum Leap, I've always considered swapping genders for a day to be a genuinely fascinating idea, and when Anton is forced to swap shells with a female colleague temporarily, I was a little let down that they didn't exhibit more than a fleeting wonderment at the event, yet very relieved, as at one point it seemed the whole exercise was a vehicle for a self-indulgent lesbian love scene, thankfully narrowly avoided. It would have been too contrived. Like Nightwatch, the film loses nothing in terms of style. Slow, sweeping, lavish shots are plentiful. The Matrix has got a lot to answer for in this respect. The making of Daywatch was clearly a labour of love. For example, the birthday party scene at the end has very high calibre guests. It is littered with Russian thinkers and celebrities. There are times, however, when they have been less careful. Special effects shots that seem a bit cheap. One example being of party guests' legs clearly jumping up and down as hard as they can until the floor beneath them caves in, whereas they would surely be running amok unless there is a Russian custom of bouncing in an emergency, of which I'm ignorant. Any real points of error are forgivable, and in fact correctable with a little more post-production TLC. The film is extremely cool and deserves its massive box office success in Russia. May it carry on kicking through the records worldwide.
Next, we have Sean Price's review of the Ian Curtis biopic Control, which was released in the cinema on the 5th of October and comes out on DVD in February.
Said that Ian Curtis wrote the line, "Here are the young men, a weight on their shoulders, not have some deep, existential, Camus-fueled angst, but as a sly dig of fellow gloommongers Echo and the Bunnymen. A little joke, if you like. It's hard to imagine, in a way, the arch-miserabilist having a chuckle at his contemporaries. A rare insight, perhaps, into another side of an icon from before the age when every two-bit minor celebrity's every shad or coke-fueled bust-up was chronicled for our daily consumption. These days, the tabs would have him writing a blog from his hospital bed after every epileptic fit. But no, his short existence is frozen in aspic as a series of immaculate set pieces. The moody, black-and-white Anton Corbijn photographs, the elegiac Peter Saville sleeves, the desolate European bleakness of Joy Division's meagre, curtailed output. It's odd, then, that it's Corbijn who really brings Ian Curtis to life for us in this biopic, even if he is still mooching around in highly stylized monochrome. Based on the book Touching from a Distance by his widow Deborah, Control tells Curtis's story from his teenage days in Macclesfield, portraying him as bright, funny and intense, if sometimes withdrawn. His romance with Deborah, an exceptional tour de force performance from Samantha Morton, features heavily in these early years. By the time he's 19, they're married. After seeing the Sex Pistols play, Curtis forms a band, soon signed up to Tony Wilson's Factory Records label as Joy Division. Later, things take a turn for the worse when Curtis suffers an epileptic fit on the way back from a London show, and at the same time, Deborah gives birth to a daughter, adding to his responsibilities. Curtis begins an affair with a Belgian girl called Annick after she interviews the band, and he's torn apart in trying to maintain two lives without letting anyone, band, wife, lover or child, down, unwilling or unable to relinquish any part. Given the subject matter and the art house photography, apparently Corbijn told the actors how to pose at the end of every scene, you could be forgiven for assuming that the film might be less than a barrel of laughs, but it rivals 24-hour Party People for hilarity, the Tony Wilson character being little more than a reprise of Steve Coogan's portrayal in that film. The real comic turn here, though, is manager Rob Gretton. As the rest of Joy Division flounder on stage following another of Curtis's grand mal attacks, Gretton bribes the lead singer of Crispy Ambulance to take to the stage in his place. After the predictable bottling off, he returns to ask where his money is. "It's in," says Gretton, "my f*** off pocket." If there's a criticism to be made of the film, it's in the pacing of the final third. We watch Curtis's descent into depression, unable to overcome his guilt, all the while haunted by the possibility of further fits. And in essence, we're waiting for the inevitable grim ending. Perhaps a more experienced director than Corbijn would have played it differently. It's a small gripe, though, when, with the aid of Morton and Sam Riley, who plays Curtis, he so successfully brings his main characters to life. We feel Deborah's pain equally as much as Ian's, a tribute to Morton's performance and the way she illustrates the crushing effect on her of Curtis's behaviour. A visual treat, then, but far more than mere iconography.
Next, Virginie Sellevy will be reading Sarah Cronin's review of the German period drama Die Falscher, The Counterfeiters, which was released in the cinema on the 12th of October and comes out on DVD in February.
In the dying years of World War II, the Nazis launched the secretive Operation Bernhard, a last-ditch desperate attempt to destroy the economies of the Allied countries by flooding their markets with forged banknotes. It was history's largest counterfeiting operation, run out of barracks 19 and 20 in the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. Austrian director Stefan Ruzowitski's compelling film explores the terrible dilemma that confronted the Jewish prisoners recruited for the operation. He has crafted a unique approach to the Holocaust genre, forsaking sentimentality for moral ambiguity, probing the motives of both the prisoners and the Nazi captors in and out of the camps. Sally Salomon Sorowich is a Russian Jew living in a decadent Bohemian Berlin of the pre-war years. A nightclub owner, loan shark, artist and counterfeiter, he forges passports for Jews trying to flee the country for financial gain or sexual favours, not solidarity. He is seemingly nonchalant about the anti-Semitism sweeping through Germany. When a guest at one of his parties derides him for being Jewish, he casually suggests that she might want to spit out the Rothschild champagne she's drinking. Finally arrested for fraud, Sally is sent to Mauthausen, a slave labour camp, where he paints portraits for the Nazis in exchange for food and a relatively comfortable existence. 8 years later, the man who arrested him, Friedrich Herzog, the excellent David Streisow, now an SS Sturmbannführer, selects him for Operation Bernhard, along with a number of more respectable members of Jewish society, fellow artists, bank managers, craftsmen. They are isolated from the rest of the camp, given soft beds, hot meals, even a ping-pong table. But Sally's willingness to collaborate with the Nazis is challenged by Adolf Burger, August Diehl, a young idealistic printer who has also been recruited for the project. Fervently opposed to aiding the Germans with their war effort, he is determined to sabotage the operation, putting the lives of his colleagues at risk. He rejects Sally's pragmatism, identifying solely with the suffering of the prisoners outside the barrack walls. Burger becomes the very embodiment of guilt, simply for being a survivor. The casual brutality and ritual humiliation suffered by Jews under the Nazi regime never ceases to be shocking or repulsive. There are the persistent insults, the constant threats of violence, the sadistic guard who urinates on Sally while he's forced to scrub toilets. However, Ruzowitski does not confine his contempt to the Germans, but subtly explores the complexities that haunted Jews like Sally and his colleague Kolia, Sebastian Urzendowski, a young artist and fellow Russian. They are caught between two impossible ideologies, National Socialism and Communism, embodied by two terrifying regimes. Sally speaks German rather than Russian, alluding to life and family in Russia that have been torn away from him. He's utterly contemptuous of Borger's socialist ideals, his own destroyed, replaced by a selfish instinct for survival. Sally, like millions of others, has been utterly eviscerated by the twin horrors that raged through Europe in those pivotal decades. Stylishly filmed and superbly acted, The Counterfeiters is a film that manages to be suspenseful, entertaining and provocative, perfectly capturing the agonizing decisions that tormented the men in Sachsenhausen.
Next, we have Jess's review of the animated thriller Princess, which was released in the cinema on the 19th of October and is available to rent on DVD now, which will be followed by Virginie's interview with the director Anders Morgenthaler.
Anders Morgenthaler's first feature successfully fuses animation with a little live action to create an aesthetically superb film with a baffling message. August, Princess's protagonist, is a young man of the cloth, who upon the death of his porn star sister recovers Mia, his abused and neglected child niece, and she joins him on a crusade of bloody revenge against every man, woman and building involved in Denmark's sex industry. The technique of merging visual formats is innovative and effective in the stylization of the picture as a whole. This technique is also used in Morgenthaler's graduation film, Araki, The Killing of a Japanese Photographer, which gives the films, and moreover the director, a definitive identity. Heavily influenced by anime, the film's gorgeous style can at least in part be attributed to the lead production designer Rune Fiske. The director's statement accompanying the publicity for this film is "fuck porno." This is clearly intended to be a politically motivated film. The pornography industry of Denmark is no doubt as seedy and savage as it is portrayed, and the film's anti-porn sentiments are obvious. Morgenthaler's actual motivations and intentions, however, are far from clear, leaving the viewer in the dark as to what the film is actually trying to say. August's mission is overtly Christian, and God literally lights the way for his merciless, blood-drenched massacre at certain points. August and Mia hold nothing back during their killing spree. August arranges for Mia, bearing in mind that the character is 5 years old, to use a crowbar to hack away the genitals and then the skull of her former abuser. This level of violence, though animated here, reminded me of Irreversible. It was hard to watch and made me nauseous. Understandably, Morgenthaler has aggressive views about porn, and what better way to vent these? However, this level of violence, accompanied by the concept that modern Christian values would support this type of avengement, is preposterous. The notion that porn is so evil that it's conquered by its literal destruction, involving psychotic waves of mass slaughter, is horrible. It makes no sense, and if anything makes Morgenthaler's anti-porn sentiments ridiculous. His hero, in my opinion, comes out even worse than his much-loathed sex industry. There's a pretentious naivety about this muddled message. The sex industry is bad, whilst grotesque violence is cool. For Morgenthaler, porn means distance, while eroticism means intimacy. Not that I'm defending the doubtlessly nasty industry that porn is, but it seems quite obvious from the vastness of it as an industry, its actual diversity as a genre, and its overwhelming and perpetual popularity. And though I'm sure that the bad outweighs the good when it comes to porn, this view smacks of being too black and white. It might simply come down to Morgenthaler being, by his own description, a neo-purist, whereas I am evidently not. Saying this, I haven't watched anything so thought-provoking for a long time. Visually, I was so impressed. I would certainly recommend watching this film, if only to spark a fiery reaction as it did in me.
I was wondering what the starting point of the film was. I was wondering whether you started with the idea of criticising the porn industry, or whether you started with the idea of having a revenge story.
I started to do it because I wanted to comment on the roughness of the porn industry.
Mm-hmm.
I had an experience with seeing some photographers from a guy called Araki, Nuboshi Araki.
Yeah.
And I really love his work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very fond of his sexuality mixture with art and so on. And he made a book called Tokyo Lucky Hole.
Mm-hmm.
Where he cruised the prostitution environment in Tokyo, in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And he started taking pictures of them in a very fine, very refined way, which is like pictures taken on holidays, you
mm-hmm.
know, because he got under the skin of these girls. So suddenly they became not sexual objects,
mm-hmm.
became like a documentary thing. And when that happened, I started also to see, you know, it's very banal, but it's, sometimes it happens to you. At that point, I hadn't seen the porn actress. I hadn't seen the sex workers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've seen the sex and I've seen the roughness and, you know, pretty much reacted like everybody else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I didn't care, actually. And then suddenly I saw these girls and saw the faces of them. And then I had this idea of saying, what is that? Was my sister? What if that was my mother or my daughter? And I think that was the turning point, because when you start thinking like that, you don't get disgusted by sex. You get disgusted by what have these people been experiencing in their life to decide to do porn?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the start of my movie with Princess, is that I like when I went from there, I found the anger, because I didn't want. I did a script where I tried to be, you know, the moral over person. This is too bad. We are all bad people because we are letting this happening. Blah blah blah. This society. Because, and I read the script and I threw it in the trash because it was crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's crap. Trying to be a moral overlord. I don't believe in that. I believe very much in sexual freedom, believe very much that people can find their own boundaries. But what I do not believe in is in the exploitation of people.
Mm-hmm.
And exploitation of people who are sad and who are scarred and mistreated.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on, if you start thinking in a near story, an intimate story about what would it be if it happened to somebody you had around you? Then you find the anger and the rage
mm-hmm.
very fast,
mm-hmm.
and there from there on it became a revenge story. So that
is that what you would do if it was your sister?
No,
you go and
no.
Like
actually, I had a big problem telling the Danish press that,
because
uh-huh. they when I'm abroad, like here in UK and all that, people seem to understand the movie a lot better.
Right.
That, you know, it's a comedy, it's a kind of fairy tale. It's not realism. It's
yeah.
based on some realism, but it's a poetic, gruesome fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
In Denmark, it was taken for, you know, it was taken exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, said, oh, that's exactly how it is. And the movie can't be treated that way, then it's way too violent and way too, you know.
So they thought that you were saying
yeah.
go out and
exactly.
kill Paul.
They said, okay, this guy believes that I should, and I can't believe they missed the point, because I think the whole point of the movie is don't do it,
yeah.
don't react like August do.
Yeah.
I think most men tend to react like that, with anger and rage and violence. We want to tear down the world, finding the bastards who is responsible. But I also think Princess has a point saying Christina is the responsible. She's responsible for her own life. She has a free will, and sadly, her free will is based on some scars and some insecurity and so on. But and I can do as much as I want to help her, but I can't save her if she keeps on not saving herself. I did it from a male perspective. If it has the movie, what the movie is saying in a very, you know, on a higher level is that if a woman had taken in Mia, I tried to put that in the start of the movie. You know, the old
Karen.
Yeah, the
yeah.
old hooker Karen.
Mm-hmm.
She's, you know, she's obviously not a strong person, or she's not a role model, but she doesn't try to find the responsible. She would probably have been a better caretaker of Mia, even though she's still a hooker. She's
yeah.
like a grandma or something like that. And of course Mia would have been a tormented kid also with her, but at least she wouldn't be dead. But my overall point is that if a woman had taken in Mia, they would have gone for some softer values. They would have gone for therapy, and you know, men can't handle therapy. They want to shoot the world.
But also, August is a priest. I was wondering whether you decided to have him be a priest because it's a very strong contrast between the priest and high moral values and everything in porn.
Mm.
Or also because you wanted the kind of good and evil contrast not to be so clear, because as a priest he should represent more values, but then in the end he's very violent, he's angry, he doesn't control his revenge, his desire for revenge. So I was wondering why.
It's a mixture of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
The when you do a movie, you can choose to make it complex or you can choose to make it banal. I didn't want to do a too complex movie, because then I think you kind of, if it's too complex, you it's hard for me to be more specific about my points.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to create a job function for August where he could react within,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I had to set up a character who lived by a set of rules, and by the first cut of the movie he was a soldier coming home from the army,
mm-hmm.
he was used to living in within a set of rules,
mm-hmm.
but then it would be too obvious that he would go berserk and kill the whole world. So I had a talk with one of the consultants I use, one of the writers, the readers I use when I do scripts, and she said, what about him being a priest? And I have thought about that, but I had, you know, the idea was gone because it was too obvious in some way. But then I thought about only making the point of him being a priest like a little thing, you know, only hinting in the start of the movie. So, okay, here's a man, he's a Catholic priest. We're not going to talk about that for the rest of the movie. Because then I had a person, and actually it was, making movies is an organic process. Thinking about it, it became very clear to me that if you want a person to go completely ape or completely berserk, then you have to take somebody from a religious belief,
because
they have a set of rules they live by. They have a moral standard. They have to have rules to control their lives,
mm-hmm.
like people who believe in astrology or whatever. You know, we're all seeking to have some security in the world,
mm-hmm.
and especially, you know, with all the horror in the world is created from religious beliefs. So in that way, just having him as in the priest costumes, it pretty much sets the rules for him reacting the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You can, you know, it's very banal, but when it's an animation movie, it becomes very much more complex, because
mm-hmm.
when you see animation, you have
mm-hmm.
to decode it in another way.
Mm-hmm. Did you worry, or I wonder if you had any reaction about this? About the fact that you're making a film that's very critical of porn, and at the same time there's very brutal violence in the film. Do you think there's a risk that some people might like the film because they enjoy those violent scenes?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big risk. To quote the other answer I had, was that men like harsh reaction to emotional things. So I like him reacting like that.
Mm.
I wish I didn't, but I like it. I like that Mia takes out this crowbar and removes this man's genitals, which is a very, very harsh, violent scene.
It is really shocking that one, because it's a 5-year-old.
Doing that.
You know, yes.
Yeah. But then the point of the scene is that she's completely ruined from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
She was a ruined girl before. The moment they did that, you experience like 5 seconds of happiness in the revenge, but the revenge is eventually ruining you.
Mm-hmm.
You can give up if you start living out revenge, then you have to give up, because then you broke all civilization rules.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on, you're only an animal.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it's complex, but it's very banal.
Mm.
In the violent content.
Mm.
To prove that I do more than continuity announcements, I'll be reviewing the next five films, starting with my review of Blame It on Fidèle, La Faute à Fidèle, a French coming-of-age drama that was released in the cinema on the 19th of October and is still showing at the Electric Cinema in Portobello Road, where The Treasures of Ages are stowed, and the Croydon Clock Tower. The political coming-of-age drama seems to be a popular strand in international filmmaking of late, encompassing a variety of genres from animation, Persepolis, to fantasy, Pan's Labyrinth. Blame It on Fidèle is a gentle comedy directed with a lightness of touch by possibly the most suitable director for this material, Julie Gavras. Her father, Costa Gavras's Irv, Z, Missing, Music Box et al., is a selection of beloved, highly political movies which suggests the young girl who is the main character in the film may be an alter ego of the filmmaker herself, as she must have grown up seeing her father move from one European country to another, and across the Atlantic as well, making movies designed to bring a passionate response to a variety of subjects. At the risk of drawing too straight a line through a director's projects, Julie previously made a documentary about schoolchildren, and the fictionalized scenes in this film have a great authenticity to them, and both her and her father have dabbled in comedy on such unlikely projects as her role as assistant director on the underrated Italian tongue-in-cheek zombie movie Dell'amore della morte, and his cameos in a couple of John Landis films. Blame It on Fidèle tells the tale of a young little rich girl growing up in early 70s Paris. And as her upper-middle-class parents discover political activism, she becomes increasingly disenfranchised, as she starts to miss the comfortable lifestyle she had previously become accustomed to. 9-year-old Nina Kerville-Bey is terrific as Anna, uprooted from her friends and toys and lavish apartment into a bewildering world where pot-smoking refugees drift in and out of her parents' apartment, and her traditional food is replaced by a smorgasbord from around the world. The fact that she's quite unlikable to start off with, as a spoilt brat who tries to teach her classmates that the proper way to eat fruit is with a knife and fork, adds to our affection for her character, who by the end is contrasted with other kids her age who were once as unlikable and stuck up as she once was, while she is now open to new ideas and cultures. Similarly, when we see from her point of view the chaos and confusion of a peaceful demonstration disrupted by heavy-handed government forces, it's all the more terrifying and poignant. Comparisons with Lucas Moodysson's Together are somewhat warranted. This mixes a well-cast family, atmospheric use of music, mise-en-scène and cinematography to create the 70s with familiar accuracy. The political upheaval of the decade and the human response to it, as ever continually echoed by current events, mainly happen off-screen, as the film generally focuses on Anna's enlightenment, with the dictated accounts of refugees and outcasts being obscured by closing doors and voices captured on microphones and rolling tape recorders. But that doesn't make the drama any less affecting, or the emotions evoked limited only to a 9-year-old's ennui. Released on the 1st of November, and still showing at the Greenwich Odeon, is 30 Days of Night. Following 2006's Swedish horror film Frostbiten, this is the second vampire film of the last year to be set within the Arctic penumbra. But its source material predates that movie, bringing to mind, if you'll forgive the comparison, the Munsters and the Addams Family race to the small screen in the 1960s. Like the Addams Family, though not a comedy, this is a film based on a dark comic, both literally and in terms of content, which has been lightened somewhat and given mainstream appeal en route to the screen. Directed by critically acclaimed indie filmmaker David Slade, this continues the last year's trend of turning cult graphic novels, such as 300 and Persepolis, into films that capture the aesthetic of their original format, and is the best vampire film since, ironically, the last notable one based on a comic book, Stephen Norrington's Blade, and that was made a decade ago. It shouldn't be that hard to make a good vampire film, have a scary, horrific lead vampire, preferably played by a magnetic character actor, I'm thinking Gary Oldman rather than Gerald Butler, if you know what I mean, make the vampire dangerous and hard to kill, use lots of creepy nighttime exteriors, and don't play it camp. Slade follows all of these rules, and faithfully adapts the original comics right down to the bleak ending. Danny Houston, better known for his revelatory, in every sense, turn as a drug addict in Ivan's Ecstasy, is terrific as the main villain, with the underrated Ben Foster, better known in 6 Feet Under and Get Over It, as his would-be Renfield. Elsewhere, Josh Hartnett is a reasonable lead, as there's always been something strangely suitable about his deadpan lack of charisma that suits horror films, Pace, Halloween, H2O, and The Faculty. And Melissa George is impressive as his estranged wife, particularly after her irritating reoccurring role in Alias on TV. The original comic book combined a gripping plot by Steve Niles and atmospheric, if occasionally impenetrable, art by sequential surrealist Ben Templesmith. While Templesmith's art is perhaps too calligraphic and full of caricature to convert verbatim to the screen, Niles originally wrote the story as a film idea, and following a string of collaborations with Clive Barker in comic books in the early 90s, he certainly knows his way around a horror story both in print and on the big screen. Occasionally, the plot feels somewhat condensed into the 113-minute running time, even though this equates pretty much to a minute per page of the comic book. And gaps of the narrative, not to mention toilet breaks for the characters, seem to have ended up on the cutting room floor. However, the pace deftly moves between brisk for the action set pieces and languid for the sequences of mounting tension. The central idea is a clever but obvious one. Vampires hide out in a town within the Arctic Circle, where during the winter there are, wait for it, 30 days of night, so they don't have to hide from the sunlight. It's amazing that no one ever thought of it before. The month-long midnight and noon of the far north has led to films as varied as the Scandinavian thrillers Insomnia and, Invasion of the Animal People, but while the varying thrills of a sleepless Stellan Skarsgård and a 20-foot abominable snowman are diverting, this is the first movie to use the location's extreme cold and light conditions to further the plot so effectively. In terms of previous horror films that this movie evokes, Slade seems to have condensed all the best bits of John Carpenter's career into one movie. The husky deaths from The Thing, the indestructible bogeyman standing in the darkness from Halloween, the almost interminable fight scene between a human and a humanoid from They Live, and thankfully skipping over the forgettable and misogynist vampires. Considering the bad patch American horror films have gone through of late, and the needless actual remakes of Carpenter's films, it's good to see someone appreciating his oeuvre for its style and content, rather than its B-movie plots. As a vampire movie, a comic book adaptation, and a difficult second film for a Brit making it big in the States, it scores incredibly well on all three counts, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Released on the 2nd of November and currently touring the world, it showed last week in Boise, Idaho, and will hopefully crop up again at a film festival near you soon, is Never Apologize, a personal visit with Lindsay Anderson. The film of a one-man show is quite a hard thing to review. Essentially, you're going to have to look at how commanding, engaging, and diverting a performance the actor gives is, and whether the material or the cinematic rendering is enough to justify capturing it on screen. Never Apologize is essentially the collaboration of three men. Malcolm McDowell is a terrific actor, whose career has descended into hammy roles in genre films like Tank Girl, Star Trek Generations, and Rob Zombie's Halloween. In these parts, he certainly still has a magnetic attraction, but 30 years ago he was one of the finest actors of his generation, who stole every scene he was in and exuded insouciant charm and sex appeal. Mike Kaplan is a Hollywood odd jobs man, who has been everything from director on the making of film Luck, Trust, and Ketchup, Robert Altman in Carver Country, to producer, publicist, and actor. Their connection is the titular third man of this trio, Lindsay Anderson, who directed McDowell in three movies of varying brilliance and was produced by Kaplan on The Whales of August, and all three were firm friends. Following Malcolm's reminiscences of Lindsay Anderson in the recent documentary Oh Lucky Malcolm, which Mike executively produced, and their realization that a young generation of film fans and filmmakers didn't know who Anderson was, McDowell performed a one-man show about his mentor at the Edinburgh Festival, and this in turn was filmed by Kaplan. In terms of cinema, this is fairly perfunctorily made. Kaplan has a good pair of cinematographers, one of whom bizarrely also worked on this month's Planet Terror as production assistant, and I can't think of two more different movies, and set of camera operators who make the framing of McDowell's performance even more dramatic and theatrical beyond the posture, gravitas, and gesticulation the man brings to the role. Equally, the editing is fluid and combines well the archive photos of Anderson and his many collaborators with McDowell's performance. Certainly, the experience of the director and one of his editors on the earlier Short Cuts documentary mean they have experience of filmmaking hagiography, which combined with the central role, elevate this above your standard American Film Institute salute to the stars. However, there aren't enough cinematic elements that are comparable to, say, the films of Spalding Gray's monologues, but then Kaplan is no Steven Soderbergh, Jonathan Demme, or even Nick Broomfield. The monologue isn't augmented either by sketches of the kind you might find in Sandra Bernhardt's Without You I'm Nothing. So all this really leaves you with is a once great actor talking about a director who died 13 years ago. Thankfully, this just about makes for a good film. McDowell is a genial host, and when he talks about his mentor who directed him in two, or possibly three depending on your point of view, decade-defining movies, there is some of the old spark in him, and the anecdotes of working on If, O Lucky Man, and how Anderson helped him get his role in A Clockwork Orange are at worst intriguing and at best completely riveting. Occasionally there are flashes of postmodernism in McDowell's approach, telling a story from his point of view and then reading out a spectator's, who was there at the time, but there aren't enough of these to make the monologue more interactive and less reverential. At times McDowell slips into lovey mode, and you mourn even more for the young actor he's telling you about, rather than the one who's standing in front of you now. However, like other recently performed monologues, such as Simon Callow's About Stroke As Dickens, this is a labour of love, and one that's highly infectious. At the very least, McDowell and Kaplan achieve what they set out to do. If you watch this movie, you'll want to see Anderson and McDowell's Mick Travers trilogy again almost immediately. However, my main reservation about the film is that this is something that will inevitably be watched by existing fans of both men, rather than newcomers to either. While Never Apologise was screening at the BFI in London, I caught up with the director and the star of the movie, and this is some of what they had to say.
You first did Never Apologise as a live performance at the Edinburgh Festival a few years ago?
That's correct.
How did it first come about?
There was a retrospective to be held at Edinburgh, at the festival, to celebrate the 10th anniversary of Lindsay Anderson's death, and I was invited to go. They said, would I come? It was a year in advance. Mm. And I said, of course I'd be happy to go, and I'll do better than just show up to a retrospective. I'll do a show about Lindsay Anderson and my whole life with him and everything else. And they said, oh, wow, that would be great. I mean, I sort of said that off the top of my head, actually, without really thinking about the consequences. Then, of course, you know, I thought, well, I've got a year to think about it. And, you know, after 9 months, I suddenly thought, oh, my God, I've got to think about this thing. And so I called everybody in England that I could think of that could send me material that I needed, particularly the archivist, Carl. What's his name, Carl?
Carl McGee
at Stirling University, who are incredibly helpful and sent me incredible stuff. And actually, I was reading through it and came across this letter, so-called, of apology to an incident that happened. And I was screaming with delight when I was reading this letter because, you know, I didn't know of its existence. And it was very important. So I asked my friend, Mike, who also... I introduced him to Lindsay Anderson, and Mike worked on O Lucky Man. So, and he produced The Wales of August. He knew Lindsay very well. They were great friends and comrades in arms. You know, we all were. So I asked Mike if he would come to Edinburgh with me and direct it, you know, and put it up. And they gave us a very nice theatre, the Travis. And really, the whole...
Apt.
Yes, Travers.
Traverse, I think.
Traverse, yeah. The whole point of the exercise really was that I realized that the general sort of population has never heard of Lindsay Anderson. And, you know, I consider him, and many other people do that know, to be the finest director that Britain had in post-war era. I think in any era, frankly, he was the most remarkable. The fact is that he only made 5 films is misleading. He was one of the leading theatre directors of his generation, and in fact, his collaboration with David Storey on all 9 plays that he directed is absolutely without precedent. It's extraordinary. And, you know, I nobody remembers now, because unless, you know, they don't even, look, apparently Jan Harlan, who's Stanley Kubrick's brother-in-law, told me that he was speaking to somebody at Warner's the other day and about Stanley Kubrick, and they said, yeah, can you spell Kubrick?
Oh, God.
So that's where we're at, you know. People forget very quickly.
So Mike directed the stage version as well as the film. I mean, when did you think
so-called
it should be filmed as well as performance?
Well, we did it. We had a bird's eye view version of the show, which they gave us in Edinburgh, and also at the National Theatre, which we did afterwards, after we did in Edinburgh. Then when Malcolm called to do a benefit in Ojai, where he lives, for the Ojai Film Festival, he said, well, you have to come, we have to do it again. This was like a year, nearly a year and a half afterwards. And one of the perks of doing this was supposedly we were going to be getting a video of it that we could use to sell and do other things with and put it on elsewhere. Anyway, turned out that
it was a stroke of luck.
We had 5 cameras at the end that are at our disposal, and one
because tell them why.
Why?
Because the guy who had the cameras was setting up a video production company, and this was a sort of trial run for him.
And he was borrowing cameras from different schools and around. And so one of them didn't work. We had 4. And we set up the cameras.
Sheer luck. Believe you me, I did not think we were making a movie of this.
No,
the fact is, he was so pissed off with me because I wouldn't come and rehearse. I was on the golf course, and I refused to finish my round early.
Yeah, we did about 2 hours for this show, which we hadn't done in a year and a half.
So, of course, he was getting very panicky, and I was just saying, you do it, just light it, just carry on.
Oh, yeah, just light it. We were in junior high school auditorium. We lost the lighting guy the day before. The sound guy wasn't perfect. The stage was different. I mean, anyway, it all worked out in the end. And when I saw the material, it was really shot well, and knew that we could put something together.
It was beautifully
together.
Lit. The guy really knew his stuff. He was a first-rate stage lighting guy. And, I mean, there's only really 3 areas to light. But he did it beautifully, and when I moved on the stage, he didn't really know the cues, but he just moved with me with the light. And it was beautifully done.
Well, not only that, it almost seems lit for film, because cutting between the master shot and, say, a shot from the side,
yeah,
you don't suddenly plunge into darkness. So
whether
he did that subconsciously, it edits very well as a film, which you wouldn't normally think of when you were lighting the stage.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's...
Well, we wanted one from the... One back shot and from the side of Malcolm coming out.
The truth is, I mean, when I came on, I said, well, what are these cameras? You know, we'll put one over here and put one there, and Mike goes and put one at the back. They went, well, we don't see any audience, you know, so because of getting releases and all that kind of stuff, we didn't want to get into that. So, you know, really by good fortune, Lindsay Anderson was smiling on us, that the really hard work was when, you know, Mike had to go through all the material, you know, 5 cameras, a lot of the shots were missing, but, you know, as Lindsay said, art is sometimes a happy accident. Because when you don't have a choice, you just stick in what you've got. And, you know, the weird thing is, it works. I mean, if it works, it works. And Mike did, I must say, a remarkable job in editing it and putting in, you know, the clips, the stills, which are very important. And the way he chose to do it, you know, he was editing up in Idaho, you know, between potato seasons, planting and growing, whatever he does up there. And it was a beautiful job, you know.
Well, it wasn't. The editing took, I think, a total of maybe 4 months by the time we, or maybe it was six. And there were about 200 visuals that are added from what the show was. And the object was to try to make it as cinematic as possible. And the film is as much, I think, about Malcolm as it is about Lindsay, because it reveals a lot of personal things about Malcolm, just watching him and how he moves and how he acts. And also, he's got the range that I don't think the audience has seen the amount of emotional and humorous and intellectual aspects of his acting that we see in the movie. I mean, it's multifaceted, and it's very funny and very entertaining and very moving. And he's on camera for nearly 2 hours.
What it reminds me of actually was some sort of middle ground between Simon Callow doing his Dickens sort of one-man show, mm-hmm. and say the Werner Herzog Klaus Kinski film My Best Fiend, where it talks about their special relationship.
Right. Oh, I didn't see. I
haven't seen either one.
I didn't think about that, but it could well be. Who knows? I didn't see either of them either, but I would like to have seen Klaus Kinski's, actually. I don't remember, though, another actor ever
Well, I mean, this was made after Kinski died.
It's
almost from the other point of view. The director's still alive.
That's interesting. Died, you know. Well, I think it's the first time that an actor's sort of done a thing about his director. I don't know. You know, it was a very special relationship, obviously. And obviously, if I do a film about Lindsay Anderson, it's got to be a film about me as well, because that...
Three-fifths of his movies.
But the relationship is about a 50-50 relationship. Yeah. So you can't really talk about one without the other. It goes hand in hand. Of course, he was a very important person in my life, but as more as a friend than even as a director. And of course he's a very important director, but because when I did If, of course it led directly to Clockwork Orange, and which is why I'm here, the National Film Theatre, today, because tonight there's a Kubrick special about him and his life. So they're all very interconnected.
Next, we have my review of Grindhouse's Planet Terror, which had its solo release in the UK on the 9th of November and is still showing at the Prince Charles Cinema in London. Quite often, a joke that is amusing among a group of friends isn't quite so funny to the outside world, who don't know their references and shared experiences. Apparently, Robert Rodriguez was hanging out in Quentin Tarantino's house one day, or vice versa, and noticed a poster for a drive-in double bill and said that he would be interested in making a double bill just like that. Quentin, or Robert, whichever way round it was, chimed in and suggested why don't we do one each and release them together, and lo, history was made. The thing is, Robert and Quentin have worked together many times before. They collaborated on From Dusk Till Dawn, QT scripting and starring, Rodriguez directing, Tarantino directed a bit of Sin City, Rodriguez supplied a few music tracks to Kill Bill Volume 2, and so on. Both directors have made films that homage their favourite genres. Tarantino loves kung fu and blaxploitation, and so made Kill Bill and Jackie Brown. Rodriguez loves action films and horror films, and so made Desperado and The Faculty. However, each of those movies was made with enough intelligence, craft, and wit to appeal beyond their B-movie genre trappings. While I have yet to see Death Proof, on the basis of this longer cut of Planet Terror, the two halves of Grindhouse are too loving a recreation of bad, uber-violent 1970s horror movies, and so rarely rise beyond curiosity value as a form of entertainment. Seeing both movies as a bona fide double bill with fake trailers for kitsch retro films by Edgar Wright, Eli Roth and Rob Zombie holds a certain guilty appeal, but since the films weren't released in that format here, or even in America after the first couple of weeks of release, each film now has to stand on its own, and both have had extra scenes added. Planet Terror is 104 minutes long, and even with the oh-so-clever missing scene from the print, feels about 20 minutes beyond its optimum length. I've seen a lot of 80s slasher movies, which perhaps are a little too late for some of the references in this film, and they generally outstay their welcome after the first hour and a half. Since Rodriguez packs in celebrity cameos from Bruce Willis and, yes, Tarantino, plus at least two openings and as many endings for the film, it could have lost some of the dialogue scenes, which try to straddle the line between cool and cheesy, but generally fall on the side of the latter. Since the film features a missing scene, if that isn't a contradiction in terms, along with authentic scratches, film burn and skipped frames, a logical progression of narrative isn't an obvious requirement, so the film could have been improved by a quicker pace rather than a bloated one. There is still a reasonable amount to enjoy in the film. It's good to see talented actors from around the world get meaty parts, particularly in a horror B-movie, which would normally see ethnic minorities among the first victims. Freddie Rodriguez and Naveen Andrews are solid TV actors, and the former is given a chance to be a bit more heroic than his hen-pecked morgue attendant in 6 Feet Under, although Andrews is playing an even more ruthless version of his Iraqi torturer with a heart of gold from Lost. Elsewhere, the creature effects are fun. The lurid machine gun replacement leg is suitably ridiculous, and the casting of genre heavies Jeff Fahey and Michael Biehn is more than welcome. However, the cumulative effect is somewhat tedious and self-indulgent. Many of the films this movie references, from Return of the Living Dead to Evil Dead 2, are better films than this one. Overall, apart from the faked 1970s film stock, this is a movie that references John Carpenter in the latter half of his career, when he turned out turkeys like Ghosts of Mars and Escape from LA, rather than the early half when he made such genre masterpieces as Halloween and The Thing. Throughout his career, Carpenter had his name attached to the title of each film he made, and for the first decade he worked as director, this hubris was justified. However, by the mid-90s, his personality seemed more important than the quality of movie he was making, instead of letting the film speak for itself, which suggested his fans were expected to come and see anything he made as long as his name was displayed prominently enough. This is an entertainment ruse going back decades, when schlockmeisters like William Castle and Roger Corman churned out cheapies that relied on their reputation for continuing box office receipts. Corman, surrounded by good material and finding a muse in Vincent Price, had a great run of hits in the 1960s, but elsewhere his B-movies are generally forgettable. Unfortunately, on the basis of this, Rodriguez's last couple of kids' films and the announcement that his fake trailer for Grindhouse, Machete, is going to be a full-length film, it does look like Robert Rodriguez has started down the same path, all too soon, in his career. Finally, we have my review of Alan Moyle's new film, Weirdsville, which was released on the 16th of November and is released on DVD in March. The sign on the way into town reads, Weedsville, population 490,000. It's a run-down post-industrial city on a wrong turn somewhere off the interstate, where disenfranchised youth get high in derelict factories and Satanists sacrifice virgins in the drive-in theatre on the outskirts of town. There are still nice parts of the city where the effluent discharge hasn't fully polluted the river, and where you can find 19th century mansions lovingly restored, home to self-help gurus and their followers. Director Alan Moyle has a love-hate relationship with cinema. After his first film in 1980, he was so disaffected that he didn't make another movie for a decade. He returned with the blistering Pump Up the Volume, a showcase for rising star Christian Slater, which provided a voice for the fears of Generation X. He again articulated the concerns of the zeitgeist, in this case corporations absorbing small-town life, with Empire Records, an endearing dramedy that helped kick-start the careers of Liv Tyler and Renee Zellweger. So what went wrong? Again. Certainly for the last 12 years, Moyle has made films that ended up in discount racks or were just plain embarrassing to watch. Whatever the cause, the director has finally made a terrific new film that follows up on the promise of his early work. Weirdsville takes a scattershot approach to its themes and subject matter, again looking at dissatisfied youth, his favourite and most successful theme, mixing heroin abuse, murder, brainwashing and suburban ennui to delirious effect. His experiences in the movie industry may have led the director to absolve all credit for the success of this film, but the ease with which he keeps so many disparate plates juggling in Weirdsville shows a filmmaker at the top of his game. Funny, moving, beautifully shot and above all bonkers, this is a film that is desperate for an audience, but no less likable for that. Occupying the middle ground between turgid stoner comedies like Dude, Where's My Car? And romanticized, stylish dramas such as Trainspotting, Weirdsville deftly moves from traumatic overdose scenes to the generic horror of Satanist rituals. from drama to outrageous comedy. This is a film made by people who love movies, acting as prospectors sifting through the detritus of modern filmmaking. Dreamlike scenes of lead actor Scott Speedman skating a foot above the ground across the urban sprawl recall Renton's journey to hospitalisation in Trainspotting, as much as Terry Gilliam's brand of magical realism. Elsewhere, the preposterous idea of a medieval battle reenactment society made up entirely of dwarves who travel around in a limousine, or Matt Frewer as the brain-damaged self-help leader strapped to a gurney and recovering from a giant icicle blow to the head, recall John Landis at his most self-indulgent. Amazingly, in spite of all these outrageous conceits, the film somehow works thanks to excellent casting and performances, good pacing, and the constant belief that all of these incidents have a point and will make sense by the end of the movie. The director hopes that this likeable melange about stoners and Satanists will garner a cult following, and I, for one, am happy to sign up. Many of the films reviewed in this podcast are available now on Region 1 DVD, but I couldn't possibly condone ordering them from international websites such as Amazon.com for less money than they'll cost over here, as it'll probably contribute to the coming recession. What I will say is that you can read text versions of many of these reviews in Electric Sheep magazine, which is available for free in many fine cinemas and online at the provocatively titled URL www.electricsheepmagazine.co.uk. If you'd like to see the video of my interview with Malcolm McDowell and Mike Kaplan, you can do so now at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. The Electric Sheep Art House Cinema podcast is probably copyright 2008 by me, Alex Fitch, under a Creative Commons license, and featured contributions by the lovely and talented Jessica Fostercue, who you can catch doing improv comedy at the Canal Café Theatre in Little Venice on alternate Wednesdays, the equally talented and lovely Virginie Selavy, editor of Electric Sheep magazine, who can be found performing with the all-girl retro dance group The Actionettes at the 100 Club in Oxford Street on the 16th of February and at the Buffalo Bar in Islington at the very end of May, the probably lovely Sarah Cronin, who I may have met at a party last month but don't remember, and the quite dishy and northern Sean Price, film reviewer extraordinaire. The Electric Sheep Art House Cinema podcast, or ESAHCP number 8, as I hope no one's going to call it, will be online next at the beginning of February, and features reviews of Sweeney Todd and Our Daily Bread, and will feature some exciting exclusive behind-the-scenes content once I've worked out just what that might be. Thanks for listening.